As an old year fades, you might take stock of what's happened to you, to things you care about. You might even look at what lies ahead. This is going to be one of those times, and the thing I care about in this case is journalism. But I'm not going to just look at the past year. I'm going to take a long view. Over the span of my lifetime, journalism has morphed, evolved, devolved, expanded, been degraded in some ways, improved in others. Everyone has an opinion on the state of journalism. Here's the opinion of one man who was a newswriter for Walter Cronkite, a CBS bureau chief in Vietnam, a CBS vice president, and then a teacher of future journalists in the U.S., Africa, Europe, and China. This is Peter Herford.
In terms of the news flow, the availability of choice, there's no comparison. This is an infinitely better world. It's a more challenging world.
Welcome to Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead, a former foreign correspondent, long based in China. And in fact, I met Peter during the decade he was teaching journalism at Shantou University in southern China. He cut quite a figure for a 70-something-year-old guy, bald, tall, and lanky, kind of hip, with a stud earring in one ear, a commanding voice, an infectious laugh, and a frank, funny, yet challenging way of teaching that endeared him to his Chinese students. Peter's decade teaching in China is a story unto itself. I'll be posting that separately. Here, we're talking about Peter's half-century-plus in journalism and what he makes of the changes he's seen. We sit in his living room, looking out at Seattle drizzle over the waterfront. I start by asking when he decided that this whole journalism thing was the thing for him.
When I got my first job. So I find myself in Alaska in 1958, and I'm an announcer at a television station. Happens to be a CBS affiliate. And the man, one man, who was our news department, quit. So my boss came to me and said, "Would you like to do news?" And I said, "Yeah, I was 22 years old. What did I know?" I said, "Sure, why not?" That began a 60-year career.
So you stumbled into it, but why did you stick with it?
If you like learning about new things, different things, and being forced to think about them, and then even report them to other people in a coherent fashion, I mean, what could be possibly be more fun and then to be paid for it?
What about, you know, sort of the loftier goal of journalism, the role that it plays in a democracy? Was that something that mattered to you at the time?
Well, certainly not on a upfront conscious way. I guess part of it is because you're always swimming against the current as a journalist. You're always fighting. Your own institution you may be fighting. It can be the government. It can be all kinds of things. But you're always in opposition to something. Some people hate that about journalism. But you learn to live with it. And then you realize, as a result of doing that, the role that you have in the society. It's not like you sit there and have great intellectual thoughts about it. It's quite natural.
So before you became a journalist, what was your exposure to journalism? Like, what did you pay attention to as a kid, as a teenager, as a young adult, as a college student?
Well, I'm an immigrant, born in Germany with German parents. We escaped by the skin of our teeth, came to the United States. My parents were 40-ish. I was 3 years old. The war was on. So living in New York, in that hotbed of immigration, my parents quite naturally spent a great deal of time absorbing as much information as they could about this new society they were in and the war that was going on, because they had left their lives behind. They were still reading German language newspapers printed in New York, that kind of thing.
Were you bilingual as a kid?
I was bilingual.
Are you still bilingual?
Yeah, I'm trilingual.
You're trilingual.
I picked up French in the meantime.
Do you think that that made a difference for you as you went forward as a kid, as a student, as a journalist, in recognizing that there's always more than one way of looking at something?
Well, more important than just having the extra language was, because my mother had always wanted to learn French and never did, she was determined that her son was going to learn French. So she sent me to a French school. That's what did it. The French education system is so different from the American. because it does involve critical thinking. You learn that as you put your thumb in your mouth in the French system, and you can't get through it without it. It's great training.
Okay, so you're back to Alaska.
Yeah.
So you're there, and you're doing what kinds of stories?
Let me turn this thing off. Those were the days when there were no satellites. Those were the days when there was no interconnection to the United States. That is, all of our programming from CBS, which was our network, was recorded here in Seattle, put on an airplane, flown to Alaska, and we put it on the air 2 weeks after the network put it on.
So this was a year before Alaska became a state.
That's right. It was the year before Alaska became a state. I did, at the time, the longest local newscast in all of television, 45 minutes long, all by myself.
How did you do that?
I sometimes wonder, but the answer is fairly simple. We had one enormous studio. It was huge. Hmm. Why? Because it was a garage, which was endowed with one camera, one black and white camera. I would go into the studio where we had three sets set up, a news set, a weather set, and a sports set. And I would position the camera to look at the news set, lock it in place, go to the desk, get the cue, I was on the air. When I was finished with whatever news segment that was, a commercial came from the control room. I got up, repositioned the camera, went to the sports set, pointed it at the sports set, locked it in, and that's how the newscast went. And that was preceded by a local interview show with, guess who? Me, interviewing somebody supposedly interesting for 15 minutes before I went on the air. Huh. So I did an hour of television, six nights a week. Sunday was off. Technically. Sunday, I pulled a board shift. I was an engineer.
And this just seemed normal to you?
Listen, you're 22 years old. You're just starting out. Everything you're doing is brand spanking new. You're learning everything. So I was having the time of my life.
So Peter spends 3 years doing all of this in Alaska. He gets a CBS fellowship to study anything he wants except journalism at Columbia University, which just happens to be his alma mater for his bachelor's and master's degree. So that puts him back in New York. He applies for and gets a job with the CBS National Network. He starts on the overnight assignment desk. It's 1961.
The overnight desk turned out to have an extraordinary amount of power because in those days, CBS News was a very small organization, 400 people worldwide, with some of the greatest correspondents who had come out of World War II. The Murrow boys were all there. Murrow had just left. I missed him by a couple of weeks.
Oh.
And what my responsibility was to keep tabs on what was going on in all of our bureaus around the world. And I had to produce the Morning Outlook, which was sort of an internal wire service. And that Morning Outlook turned out to be what set the agenda for the next day. Who was doing what? What was going on, what was likely to go on, all those kinds of things. It took me no more than a week or two to figure out, holy cow, I really have some power here.
So there you are at what was to become arguably the most influential news organization in the United States in the 60s at the beginning of a decade that was quite extraordinary for the country.
Oh. Right after I got there, CBS News had a new president by the name of Dick Salant. To all of our horrors, he was a lawyer. And we thought the world had come to an end. A lawyer was going to run CBS News. Well, he was there for 17 years, and after his first year, all of us would have died for him. He turned out to be the man who gave the foundation to what CBS News was all about to all of its audiences, why it became as influential as it did. He, coming into that organization, immediately started to plan an expansion of the evening news, which in those days was 15 minutes. But the day President Kennedy was assassinated, the world changed. The world of television changed. The world of news changed. The expectations of the public changed. And I suppose you could draw a line saying It said something about the future of print at that point.
Why is that?
Because suddenly, a medium that only people who had an intense interest in news paid any attention to, and then it was terribly disappointing because the news we did in 15 minutes was a bad joke in terms of our capabilities. It wasn't serious. Not serious that we didn't have serious stories, but compared to the New York Times or the Washington Post or any other newspaper, even a worse newspaper, we were nothing. Suddenly, with the assassination of President Kennedy, we and NBC2 were on the air for 4.5 days, nonstop. Television had never done that with anything. The public came to expect this of television, that when events occurred, they wanted to see it on the TV set. Now nobody even thinks about that. Of course, you know, you don't even go to your TV set. You pull out your smartphone, you go click, and you're watching.
Now it's perhaps gone a little too far. I mean, where you have like 6 hours of coverage of a storm. It's like, okay, it's still raining. We get it. You know?
Yes, but any time in that 6 hours you want to check in on the storm, it's there.
Right, but there are a lot of other things that are going on in the world too.
And they're so available too.
Not necessarily, because if you're throwing all your resources at the storm and
you're not
paying attention to other things, a lot of news organizations now do that. I mean, CNN, Fox, I mean, when they decide to go full bore on one story, and you're not hearing about all
other
the other things
organizations
that are
happening. We're not so familiar with do it. The point is there's a proliferation of sources now.
Mm.
Yes, in terms of cable, which, by the way, itself is dying because of the internet. Cable has a finite number of news sources. And you're right. They pounce all on the same story, very often showing the same pictures, all that sort of thing. It's utter nonsense. It's ridiculous. But it's not that you don't have a choice. You can go click off on them and go to other sources and get what you want from angles you never had before. I mean, from foreign sources. So, yes, what you're saying is absolutely right. But it's not that you're cut off from everything else. It's the other things, because of the fact that they're all being so idiotic, doing the same thing. And we used to do that too. I mean, one of the terrible things about network news in those days was, if you tuned into NBC or CBS, who were the dominant networks at the time, almost every night our lead stories were the same.
Huh.
And if you take a step back and you look at that and say, come on, our competitive thing was, if they lead with this and we don't lead with this, we must be wrong, or they must be wrong by not leading with what we did.
Back to your time at CBS.
Yeah.
So there was the Kennedy assassination. It transformed how people looked at television news.
Mm-hmm.
You also shifted in your career. You became a writer for Walter Cronkite.
Yes, actually before the assassination. He had been reading my overnight stuff, and apparently he liked my writing. So he invited me to join the team that was planning the 30-minute newscast. We had a test team, if you will, put together, because in those days, can you believe this? People were saying, how can you do a half hour of news? How are you going to fill it? What are you going to put in it?
And you'd been filling 45 minutes of news all by yourself.
All by myself. And I never put those two things together. Well, suddenly we had a national audience. The idea of, we may come to the end and not have enough. It was a frightening thought, a really frightening thought.
So what was Walter Cronkite like as a boss?
Part of his contract that he had with CBS News was that his title on the broadcast was not anchorman. It was managing editor. Old newspaper term, right? And the managing editor of a newspaper in those days was the super boss. Nobody interfered with his or her, and there were hardly any hers in those days, but his news judgment. And that's what he demanded. He demanded that kind of editorial control. So he set the news agenda. Now, we all offered ideas. We made offers to him. But he did the picking and choosing of what the news agenda was going to be that day. So that was number one. Number two, writing for Walter was the experience of, any wire service reporter knows this, write tight and write fast. But writing tight for Walter meant he averaged 6 minutes of the 22 himself. In his 6 minutes, he tried to get as much news into that broadcast as possible, which included the introduction to the longer correspondent segments. And his talent was to take a news story that you wrote in maybe 15 or 20 seconds, pull 5 seconds out of it, and not lose anything. That's a real skill.
So you kind of learned to write news in haiku.
That's right. Exactly. That was his thing.
Now, at the time that you were working with him, there was a survey that came out that showed that most Americans were getting most of their news, all of their news, from television broadcast news.
Yeah, that was later on. That was in the Vietnam War. 85% of the American public was getting all of their news from ABC, CBS, or NBC. And Walter was appalled. And he called us all in and he said, look, we have a new job. Our new job is we've got to get more news into the time we have. And that meant writing even tighter.
So do you think the 60s were kind of exceptional in terms of how people viewed journalism and the role of journalism because of what was happening in society, because of the reaction to the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, the feminist movement? There was just a lot going on and people
started
to pay more attention.
It was the civil rights movement that was the biggest thing. That was a revolution. No two ways about it. That was a major revolution in the United States. And very much like the Kennedy assassination, we brought that home to living rooms. And people were looking at things and saying to themselves, this is the United States? Things like this are going on in this country? By then, I had become Midwest bureau chief. I spent the entire time in the South being a field producer. And that experience obviously helped form me, but gives me the perspective for what's going on today.
When you look at this particular story come around this time, what strikes you about the way it's being covered?
Part of the answer, I think, is that Black Lives Matter has the ability to do things that they could not have done 20 years ago, simply because they have got outlets to take action, to make themselves heard, to get their message out that were not available to them before. And I think probably to a certain extent to their own surprise, they've taken root a lot faster than they might have in the past when they might not have taken root at all. I mean, there are organizations 10, 15 years ago who were doing exactly the same thing and were frustrated out of their minds because nobody was listening.
So you covered the civil rights movement. You then covered the Vietnam War.
Right.
What did covering the Vietnam War teach you or show you or reveal to you about what information was getting to the American public and what was being kept from them by the government, what you as a journalist needed to do to kind of bridge the gap?
When I went to Vietnam as the CBS bureau chief, we had access to everything and anything we wanted. Yes, there was the official version of the war. Every afternoon at 5 o'clock, the military did a briefing, which got to be called the 5 o'clock follies, because it was a folly. But we all dutifully went and reported what the government was saying. But the entire rest of the time, we were out in the field, being taken out into the field and protected by the American military to report exactly the opposite of what the government was reporting. Now, that had never happened before. I mean, World War II had censorship, and we had none. Nobody ever interfered with anything we did, or even, in my experience, even tried.
Why do you think that was? What made Vietnam an exception?
Naivete. Simple as that.
They thought you as journalists would be on their side, telling the same story.
Not necessarily on their side, but they thought we would do a job they could live with.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe naivete is going too far. I think this was the classic, the Washington view of the war versus the Vietnam view of the war. They had put command in place that basically agreed with Washington. What we were doing, how we were doing it, the values of what we were doing, protect the South Vietnamese way of life and democracy and all the good things. The reality on the ground was totally different. And there were many, many in the American military and in the American civilian establishment who were sending that message back to Washington. But they were deaf. They didn't want to hear it, and when you don't want to hear it, you don't believe it when it's being said to you, and you've got all of your own people telling you the opposite. Things are going fine. Just send me more troops and we'll win this thing. And that kept going. That vicious circle kept going. And then there was this nattering crowd of journalists, which, by the way, turned out to be huge, and they were worldwide. Other countries were way ahead of the United States in understanding the idiocy of that war.
So when you were there, how many people were watching the evening news on CBS?
I know the audience for the CBS evening news in those days was larger than the audience is today for all three networks combined.
So you were really having an impact with the stories that
huge,
you were telling.
Huge. To the American public, this was being pounded daily into their heads, very much as the civil rights movement. What the hell is going on here? Somebody's got to do something about this.
There was a moment when your former boss, Walter Cronkite, kind of stunned the American public with what he had to say about the Vietnam War.
To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To suggest we are on the edge of defeat is to yield to unreasonable pessimism. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion.
And if you go back and if you read that, what people and he considered an editorial, it's so mild you would sort of smile today compared to what you can watch on Fox News any night of the week. He, being who he was, said, listen, I've got to get out there and look at this. We're reporting this every day. I haven't been there. I want a chance to have a look at this. And at that point, he was, you know, the most trusted man in America, and the American military, certainly Washington, saw this as the golden opportunity. And they laid out the red carpet and made anything available to him that he wanted. And he fought very hard to do exactly the opposite of what they wanted him to do, because they wanted him to talk to nothing but the top military commanders and hear the story that they wanted to put out. So he worked with, I wasn't there at the time, he worked with the correspondents and the producers who were there at the time, and he got what he needed within 24 hours. I mean, he went out into the field, talked to troops on the ground, and came back in a major depression. And by the time he got back to New York, which I think was a week or 10 days later, he had already started wrestling, because those of us who worked with him never knew what his political leanings might even be. We had him everywhere from far right to far left. We had no clue as to what Walter really felt about things. So in that atmosphere, you can imagine what it took for this man to get on the air and give his opinion of what this war was about. That was total antithesis to his view of what the role of the anchorman was.
What do you remember of the public reaction to that?
Oh, it was about a 9 earthquake.
Were people calling him unpatriotic or saying...
Remember what Lyndon Johnson said?
Remind me.
We lost the war. We lost Cronkite. And he was right. Now, did that single event do it? No, but it was that important. Certainly to the CBS News audience who heard it that night, it was something that they had never expected even to hear from this guy, whom they had put all their trust in. It was on everybody's lips. It got talked about. The newspapers helped enormously. It was headline news in newspapers all over the United States, and it didn't go away. And, of course, it gave a shot to the anti-war movement.
For a span of time, and you were there for the whole time, CBS and the networks more generally had this outsized influence. They had extraordinary resources. Do you think that that was healthy? Do you think that that was a good way of providing journalism for a population? Or do you actually look at the explosion of different sources now and think that's better serving the public?
For our egos, it was much better the other way. Really was. We reveled in it. We didn't ask ourselves the questions we should have been asking. And there's no question, this is a far better world, much better. The challenges are much greater for you, the audience, But in terms of the news flow, the availability of choice, there's no comparison. This is an infinitely better world. It's a more challenging world.
What about the level of rigor that journalists bring to what they're doing? When you look at what's out there now, when you deconstruct stories that you're reading or hearing or seeing, how does it compare with what you were doing back in the 60s and 70s?
Well, we were our own rigor. We had to come up with that. And that's why I keep coming back to somebody like Cronkite or Dick Salant. They were so rigorous on us. They gave us the culture that we lived in. And that's the reason I think CBS News was successful. And it wasn't any much less successful at NBC. NBC had their own rigor, too. They didn't quite have the strong personalities we had, but they were damn good at what they were doing. And they very often beat us, too. Now, the same thing was true in print. Reporters and the editors at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the great papers of the day had that same weight on their shoulders. They recognized that they were the guardians of the standards, the ethics, and all that went with good journalism. Now the world has changed. A lot of that has now fallen on the shoulders of the users of the information. You have to do the work that the old editors did, which means there are people out there, because journalism has exploded. I mean, there are more jobs in journalism now than ever before in the history of journalism. Some of them pay unbelievably badly. Some pay none at all. Others pay increasingly well. That's the economics of journalism.
If they pay none at all, is that a job?
Sure it is. Of course it is. Because if you're in love with journalism, there are people in journalism who say, don't ever let them know, but if they didn't pay me, I'd pay them to do the job. It really is that good a job.
Well, I wouldn't argue with that, except, I mean, I agree. It's a great job. But how do you create a generation of journalists who can kind of grow up and mature as journalists and use the experience that they've gained along the way if they can't pay the rent?
I think the way you become a journalist and the way you learn in journalism has also changed. I'm in that school of thought that says anybody can be a journalist. What you need is a brain and judgment and all the things that go into good journalism. And that can come from anybody.
So you have all these people who, I mean, anyone really, if they want to write something and put it online or do a podcast or whatever, they can do it. And you're saying that users now need to be the ones who bring the rigor to the process of figuring out, how much do I trust this source? How do I know that this is accurate? How do you think users are doing?
Very badly. Because they're falling into a terrible trap, which is our natural penchant to want to be in an echo chamber and hear ourselves coming back at us and watching, listening, and reading things that agree with us and not taking the trouble to do the opposite and look for stuff that is uncomfortable. That's a human failing. It has a long history. It's not about to change. That's why an organization like Fox seems to be as successful as it is. It isn't. If you look at the Fox audience, it's infinitesimal.
It's like 2 million.
Yeah, right.
Maybe 3 million.
Day in, day out, they're under a million. There are fewer people watching Fox or CNN, for instance, during normal daytime hours than watch a single newscast in New York City on one television station.
Hmm.
But our ability to make noise is incredible. And the genius of Fox is the genius of the man who created it, who has created an impression that Fox dominates the world.
Well, it's also amplified because other media pick up on Fox says and does, or what CNN says and does.
This is the failing in part of traditional journalism, because we still have a tendency to be lemmings and follow each other. And what has just passed in the most recent debate with the Republicans, right? The next day, in reading what I normally read, which is a number of the traditional great newspapers, and even other sources that are more remote, they're all over this story saying the same thing over and over, as if there's nothing else going on in the world. It's mind-boggling. It's just frustrating as hell.
Well, as if there's nothing else going on in the world, and also in watching the debate, there was no fact-checking along the way. There was no pushback about, you just said something that was completely untrue. And so it's left to stand, and people who are watching the debate who don't have any context, who don't have the time to read widely and decide for themselves what is actually the case, they just take it on face value.
Yeah, but, you know, the traditional answer to that from them would be the standards of traditional journalism.
We report, you decide.
That's right. Not only you decide, but we don't get involved.
But those weren't the standards before. It was that there was an expectation, certainly when I was in journalism school in the early 80s, we were told that, you know, your job is you report the heck out of the story and you get as close to the truth as you can and you fact check everything. That's your job.
But we're talking about live television. A debate is live television. I would agree with you in this sense. The moderators of those debates, they know enough or they should know enough. And where they know better, they should be jumping in.
Don't you think viewers and consumers of news, viewers, readers, listeners, want journalists to say, you know, look, we know this is true?
Most of the audience wants to hear what they want to hear, not what you're telling them, particularly if you're telling them something that's against their grain.
So then what's the role of a journalist? I mean, it's not a popularity contest,
no,
right?
No. It is to do what we've always done. Get as close to what happened as what did happen. And we're not very good at it. We never have been and we never will be, certainly on a day-in, day-out basis.
Well, what happened, what it means, what are the underlying issues,
means,
what are the underlying trends?
That's a leap.
But if you don't have the context, what happened is just a data point.
Yeah, but it's one thing to report what you're actually seeing and what you're actually hearing, which, by the way, is usually flawed. Because somebody else is hearing something else and seeing something else from a different angle. Mm-hmm. You're both right, but you're both wrong. So you've got that aspect of journalism. Then you've got the other aspect, which is analysis, context. What does this mean? Why is this going on? You have your opinion. I have my opinion. That's why we have commentary pages and editorial pages and why we hopefully separate things and get very careful about what we put in the news story.
So I think it's different saying, I think this is good or bad, versus here's the context in which this is happening, which is called analysis, which is part of what goes in the news hole.
Hey, you and I might have some arguments about that. Okay. You see, I would say, yes, it needs to be there, but in a separate box.
So when you read The Economist, I mean, The Economist is all analysis.
Yes, and I know that. And this goes back to another principle we haven't talked about, which is what's permissible and what is not permissible in journalism.
Okay.
And my answer to that question is, do anything you want, just tell me what you're doing. And then I will have the context that I need.
So this podcast is called Whose Century Is It? You've spent well over half a century in journalism, both as a practitioner and as a teacher. As you're looking at where we are now and how we move ahead as a society, let's say specifically in the United States, mm-hmm. you've said, you know, it's never been a better time in terms of what's available. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the role that journalism plays in the United States, in this democracy, how are you feeling?
Just as optimistic.
Just as optimistic.
I think what is the opportunity that has not existed before is a little bit what we talked about before, which is, there are now so many ways of doing journalism and ways of getting that out of your system. Whether you're doing it as an avocation or as your life's work, that only grows. That becomes bigger and bigger. Don't expect to have 3 million people listening to you, watching you. You're going to have to be satisfied with a much smaller audience. You may go viral. You may do something that suddenly has 5 million people, and it'll last 24 hours. The world of information has only begun to be touched. We are at the baby steps. And I could project in 100 different directions where this could possibly go. The only one I have any confidence in is more. And that presents its own challenges.
Is there anything where you look ahead and you think, whoops, this could really be a problem if it continues the way it's going?
Well, first of all, it isn't going to change. It's only going to get more of what it is. So that option isn't there. I mean, we're not going to go back to another time. We're going to go forward to something else. The danger is already there, which is the ability to do dirty work has also expanded enormously. You can make more mischief now, faster than ever before in the history of mankind. And because, unfortunately, viewers, listeners, so forth, are as lazy as they ever were, you can get away with it. There's a limited amount of time. And I think an organization like Wikipedia has taught us, since anybody can go in there and add anything to a Wikipedia piece, a lot of people have tried to put in bad information. It doesn't last more than a few seconds before somebody pounces on it and corrects it. And the same thing is true of all other things that are on the web that are in any sense accessible. You can make mischief and you get caught up. Good example at CBS. Dan Rather's career ended because of people who picked apart a story that he and his producer put on television before it ever got off the air. It was on the air when they came on and questioned the source material that was used and that turned out to be flawed and where the whole story came apart. And the end result was Rather retired and his producer was fired.
So there are shoals to navigate for journalists. But overall, it's interesting that you're feeling very positive, very optimistic about the future.
More than I've ever felt.
Peter Herford, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I love Peter's optimism. He seems to delight in the endless exploration of news sources the internet now offers, and he's sure more adroit at finding them than any other 80-year-old I know. It's also impressive how comfortable he is rolling with the changes in our field, which have knocked many a journalist half his age off balance. Then again, Peter did have a long stretch of getting paid well to do what he loves. I wonder what it will be like for the generation just coming into journalism now. As to our conversation on context and analysis, I think it reflects a generational shift. In Peter's heyday, journalists thought of themselves as objective. Since then, it's become more common to accept that everyone brings their own lens, their own experience to what they do, and they should be aware of that and should try to correct for it, go out of their way to test their assumptions and listen to other perspectives. After all, there are so many subjective layers in doing a news story. What story? From what angle? Doing what research? Using which bits of the research? Quoting whom and why? And why not others? And that's not even getting into the placement the story gets when it's published or posted or broadcast. So I agree with Peter. It's an incredible thing that so many more voices can now tell their own stories their own way. As he said, it is a challenge to figure out who's worth listening to, who to trust, but it can be done. It is being done. Another generational shift is underway. I wonder what I'll be saying about the state of journalism when I'm Peter's age. I can only aspire to being half as hip and as comfortable with riding the waves of change. Meanwhile, I'm grateful to him and his generation of fellow journalists for the example they set and the inspiration they gave kids like me way back when we were watching Walter Cronkite in 60 Minutes and starting to imagine a life in journalism. What do you think of the way journalism has changed, how it's being practiced these days, and what might change going forward? Leave a comment on our webpage, pri.org/century, where you can also find previous episodes, essays, and other extras. Suggestions for future topics for this podcast are welcome, too. Leave them on the webpage, or tweet me at Mary Kay Magstead, or drop an email at whosecentury@gmail.com. If you like the podcast, subscribe on iTunes, and while you're there, rate us and leave a review. You can also find us on SoundCloud and Stitcher. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me, Mary Kay Magstead, and PRI's The World, in partnership with the BBC and WGBH. It's sponsored by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. Hope you'll join us then.